Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The United States has embarked on both military and humanitarian missions in Iraq, facilitating an end to the humanitarian crisis on Mount Sinjar, where some 40,000 Iraqis were trapped and facing what President Obama called genocide. Meanwhile, Islamic State militants continue to progress towards the Kurdish capital of Erbil, and a new government threatens the remaining power of the Iraqi government. Joining us now from Baghdad to talk about the latest updates in Iraq and U.S. intervention is New York Times Baghdad Bureau Chief Tim Arango. Welcome to the show, Tim.
Thank you for having me.
From where we sit, it feels like constant change over there right now.
Yes, it's a pretty fast-moving, dizzying story. You had Obama, I don't know, a week ago, using the word genocide, and then apparently there was this mission yesterday, and they discovered that, there are tens of thousands of refugees still on the mountain, and that there probably won't be the need for a huge rescue operation. And then, of course, in Baghdad, you have this political drama playing out, and today, for the first day, things are kind of quiet here here in the capital, so which is actually nice after so much activity.
Why the discrepancy in the numbers in the mountains?
You know, that's a good question. I wasn't there. I'm not up north. I'm in Baghdad. But it seems to me that they, the American story is the U.S. airstrikes worked and people had been off the mountain for a while or had been coming off steadily because the airstrikes were working. And there's also a possibility that the very high number, I think I saw at one point 200,000 trapped somewhere, may have been too high. So we just don't know at this point.
Why are the Yazidi people being targeted in this way?
You know, the Yazidis for Islamic extremists, I've been to Sinjar. I remember doing a story there a couple of years ago. And Yazidis, it's an ancient religion. It has elements of Islam, but it's not Islamic. It's not Christianity. But extremist Muslims basically think of them as devil worshippers and think they need to die. And that's basically it. It's this distorted, ideology where I need to kill you because you believe in something different.
Is their faith something that it developed in somewhat in isolation? Is that why we don't know a lot about it, or?
No, it's a minority. It's a very minority religion, but it's older than Islam. It's older than Christianity. I'm not an expert on it.
Okay.
I think most people are not experts on it.
What's happening with the government in Baghdad now?
It's very interesting. So we have the Prime Minister Maliki, who's been Prime Minister for 8 years, and Sunday night, it was about midnight on Sunday, and I was, for whatever reason, still in the office, and word came out that he was going to speak very soon, and then rumors happened that tanks were going into the streets, and it was kind of an interesting night. He was being very defiant about relinquishing power. Most people want him gone, from his Shiite one-time allies to the Sunnis to the Kurds to the Iranians to the Americans. So this week, they named a nominee to replace him. He's backed away from using the army and says he will mount a legal challenge, which is progress. So he hasn't given up yet, but this idea that there's going to be a coup, that feels like it's gone away for now.
So it's Haider al-Abadi. He's a Shiite. He was nominated Monday, as you said, to be Iraq's new prime minister. Whoever they are, have given him 30 days to form a government with Sunni and Kurdish factions. Tell us about who he is and what this 30 days means and if it's likely to occur.
Well, he has 30 days under the Constitution. That's just process.
Gotcha.
He gets a shot. And so people hope that he can do it before then so he can get the government going. He's from the same party as Maliki, and I think that's one of the big reasons that they settled on him, because they can say, we acknowledge your victory in the election, because Maliki's bloc did win the most seats in the election, because he had a lot of popularity. He's lost a lot of it since all these dramatic events that started happening in June when the militants took over Mosul. So he's in the same party. I wouldn't say he's an unknown, but he's not someone who is thought of as an especially strong personality. He's from the same party, sort of similar life story as Maliki in some respects, in that he lived abroad for a lot of his adult life, working in opposition against Saddam Hussein. I think the big difference is that Abadi worked in politics. Maliki's whole thing when he was in exile was, you know, clandestine military operations against against Saddam. So, you know, however Abadi's past shaped, you know, his worldview and his character, we'll find out.
My guest is Tim Orango. He's Baghdad bureau chief of the New York Times. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. What is the constitutional basis for removing Maliki?
Oh, there's no, there was elections.
Right.
It's just the process of forming a government. He's basically, when he's making his argument that he should stay, he's not saying, I have to be prime minister. What he's saying is, it's a constitutional technicality that he has the first, that he should have the first chance to form a government.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, even if he had that chance, he wouldn't be able to do it because he's lost so much support. When I mean form a government, it's all that bargaining you do to get, you know, ministries to different parties, so then you can have your cabinet approved in parliament, and that's when you officially become prime minister.
On the Kurdish front, the Islamic State and militants are moving toward the capital, Erbil. How long until they arrive there? What's being done to stop them at this point?
Yeah, I think that advance has stalled. It's
okay.
Stopped. That's what really prompted the Americans to come in and launch a bunch of drones and airstrikes. They were, you know, people woke up one day and they were like, oh no, these guys are getting pretty close to Erbil. I went up to Erbil right after Mosul fell, and Erbil's not that far from Mosul. And there was no thought that that territory in the Kurdish area was going to be a threat, was going to be under threat by ISIS. So it was very, very surprising. I think it was a week ago, 10 days ago, whenever it was. I lose track of time right now with the story. But
right.
It was very, very surprising, and I think that's what prompted President Obama to act fairly quickly.
So what's happening to the people in Iraq? They're just being flushed from one place to another. The folks coming out of the mountains, where are they going? Wherever they are, what's being done to take care of them? Because we're talking about mostly civilians at this point, right?
Yeah, I mean, you go up to Kurdistan. I've been covering Iraq for a while, and you know, there's always flights of refugees up there. A year ago now, there was a huge influx of Syrian Kurds into the Iraqi Kurdish region, like 40,000 of them in one day, coming over the same, you know, the same area where the Yazidis are coming. So up there, you have a lot of people who fled the fighting in Syria. You have the Yazidis now who left in there. You have people from Mosul. You have people that left earlier this year from Anbar because, you know, Iraq didn't just blow up in June when Mosul was taken.
Mm-hmm.
These guys have taken Fallujah at the end of December. 500,000 people left Fallujah and Anbar, and many of them were up north. So it's a place where, you know, a huge displacement crisis.
ISIS or the Islamic State militants, I'm not sure it was the New York Times or the Washington Post or what, but that it's the most powerful, most well-funded militant Islamic militant organization in history. What's behind it? Where are they getting how that's pretty dramatic. You agree with that description? And where
yeah,
are they
I mean
getting...
everything. You know, they become self-financing by now, so they don't rely on donations from, you know, sheikhs in the Gulf or places like that. It's completely self-financing because of the territory they've taken, oil smuggling, things like that, extortion. They're able to generate a large amount of money now because they have this territory. When they took Mosul, they robbed the bank. Even before they took Mosul, Mosul was a capital of finance for this group, even before they took control of it through extortion schemes. Americans estimate that they were making $12 million a month in the Mosul area from extortion schemes.
What about further developments in U.S. military strikes? From what I understand, the U.S. pulled back on that score because it turned out there weren't these tens of thousands of people trapped in the mountain. What's going on with that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that came last night. So there have not been, as far as we know, any airstrikes today. It seems to me that they're still waiting to see what happens with the government, because they've launched these airstrikes to save Erbil and to help protect the Yazidis, but they've also implied, Obama's implied, that there's perhaps even broader military support for Iraq that's contingent on them forming a new government, which is basically contingent on Maliki going. So I think there's a lot of people in the administration who are waiting to see what kind of government is formed. If it can be an inclusive government, that suggests there may be a political way to move towards solving this problem.
I get that Haider al-Abadi is a Shiite. He was from the same party as Maliki. But from what I understand, he hasn't necessarily held any kind of particular public office. How does one form a coalition in that kind of vacuum of, you know, previous experience?
Well, he was a minister. He's been an MP. I mean, he's a well-known politician. These guys know him. And I think there was so much antipathy against Maliki, and that it came down to anybody but Maliki. So now that there is, is a new nominee, I don't think they'll have any problem finding getting a new government.
How involved are American officials in the choice of al-Abadi and how the formation of the government goes forward?
Well, the Americans definitely work behind the scenes to oust Maliki. I don't think they said Obeidi has to be the guy. I don't think they chose him. But they definitely did all they could behind the scenes to make sure that Maliki was gone. And I think they'll be talking to everybody during the government formation process as well to get the Sunnis back into the political process.
So as they step back and wait for this government to be formed and see, you know, what happens to decide what the United States does going forward militarily, what about the militants? I mean, you said they've pulled back from Erbil, but what is expected next?
I mean, they have a lot of territory. They, like, basically run half of Iraq. So they're going to get stronger and stronger in that area. We could see them mount offensive operations. I don't think they'll approach Erbil, but, yeah, that's a good point. The longer everybody waits for a government in Baghdad to be formed, the militants are not waiting, of course. Excuse me. Mm-hmm.
Well, Tim Orengo, I want to thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Yes, I'm happy to be with you. Thank you.
Take care and be careful.
Yes, thanks. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tim Orengo, he's bureau chief for the New York Times Bureau in Baghdad. Coming up, we continue the conversation about what's going on in Iraq and the United States' response to efforts there. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. U.S. humanitarian aid missions are underway in Iraq, and now that the U.S. is again involved there, many are asking, what's the long-term strategy? Joining us now to discuss U.S. policy in Iraq is director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Sean Kay. Sean, welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Also joining us now is distinguished scholar in the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C., Aaron David Miller. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Pleasure to be here.
So Haider al-Abadi, he's a Shiite who was nominated Monday to be Iraq's new prime minister, has 30 days to form a government with Sunni and Kurdish factions. What are your expectations for al-Abadi and the 30-day deadline, which is a constitutionally set deadline?
Is that to me?
Yes. Sorry.
I mean, I think we have to have a pretty low set of expectations for what constitutes political power sharing and reconciliation in Iraq. The good news for Abadi is he's got the Iranians, the Saudis, and the Americans, and moderate Kurds and Sunnis, and a fair number of Shia to support him. The bad news is that the issues of governance, after years of Maliki's corruption and dysfunction, have created a pretty huge perception that Iraq's political elite simply cannot function is not prepared to deal with the economic and political issues that would generate real power sharing. And I think we had a conference call yesterday here with Barham Saleh, who used to be a deputy prime minister of Iraq, Zal Khalilzad, a former ambassador, and Samir Soumaidi, the former Iraqi ambassador to the United States. And the consensus there was that forget reconciliation. We're talking here about transactional power sharing, understanding the fact that you have three communities who will want some measure of decentralization. So the notion of a coherent, cohesive, centralized Iraqi state is going to have to face up to certain confederal realities. And I think over time, there's a good possibility that we can move to a better place than where we are, but Iraq is going to remain for quite some time dysfunctional.
Now, the issue of three separate states was considered at one point before the United States withdrew its troops in the first place, right?
Well, I think it simply attests to a certain reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you don't have a legitimate political contract between the governed and those who govern, if a central government doesn't have control over the vast amounts of its territory, if you're confronted with militias that are backed by external powers, that's not a sovereign state. And Iraq has not been sovereign, even though it's had centralized authoritarian governments under both Saddam and Nur al-Maliki. That I think, is the basic problem. You don't have Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia who are prepared to surrender to those who govern power, and they're mistrustful, suspicious, and well, they should be. So, on balance, I guess what I'm saying is I don't think Iraq necessarily has to split into three discrete entities.
Okay.
But I do believe you'll see any solutions have to take into account the confederal realities of Sunni, Shia, and Kurdish entities.
We're talking about the state of Iraq and American involvement over there today, tomorrow, and going forward. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So American officials helped choose al-Abadi. They also helped nominate Maliki 8 years ago. Is there concern that maybe American officials shouldn't be participating in this at this stage? Or is that just irrelevant and not even imaginable?
I mean, we're not driving the train on Iraqi politics.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, because of threats to Americans in Erbil and the Yazidis on Sinjar Mountain, the president decided to deal with that through the insertion of, I guess, what you could call, it's now almost 1,000 special operators.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the reality there is to deal with a immediate threat posed by ISIS or ISIL, and also to create a contingency in the event you wake up one morning and Baghdad is there at the gates of Baghdad. We have a large embassy. Those special operators are there to secure the airport, to secure evacuation routes. And we have joint operations centers with the Iraqis, two of them. One of them is in Erbil and a consulate there. There are Americans there. So we can't afford to have ISIS knocking on their doors. That combined with this genuine humanitarian catastrophe, which was small enough that the president could actually act in a way to somehow address it, I think so far explains his risk readiness when it comes to Iraq. This is a very risk-averse president. I mean, he's the extricator-in-chief. His mandated mission is to get America out of the two longest and arguably among the least profitable wars in its history, where the standard for victory was never could we win, but when could we leave? And he's now faced, sadly, and it's a cruel irony, with the reality that he may well be drawn back in response, not to something that's old or conventional, but to something that's quite new, the emergence of this group, 15 to 25,000 fighters in Iraq now, more in Syria, who are well-armed, well-disciplined, with a megalomaniacal ideology and a lot of money. So this is serious, far more serious than Al-Qaeda. And this is not something that can be dealt with today or tomorrow. He will not fix this problem by the time he leaves the White House. But his predecessor, he and his predecessor, have to agree on some sort of strategy to contain it.
Sean Kay?
Yeah, I think Aaron has explained it exactly right. I think one additional bit of context I'd add is that, if you might recall, back in 2006 or so, we developed the idea of a surge in Iraq, that we would send more troops. And the troops did their job very well, but that was one part of what was intended to be a broader strategy that was to include oil sharing and political reconciliation, and in particular regional diplomacy that would try to engage constructively the actors involved. Al-Maliki, over time, you know, I suppose they had to deal with the person that was there, but he ended up being a pretty bad actor. So one of the key tipping points on ISIS right now also is that they're there also making alliances with local Sunni groups, and the Sunni groups may or may not want to align with them, but they're also afraid of the Shiites. So there is a possibility of a long-term threading of the needle here that that brings about a change in the government and brings in the regional actors that that Aaron was rightly talking about. But that is going to be mainly a political and diplomatic effort. The role of the military here strikes me as extremely limited in terms of actually being able to, perhaps we can degrade the ISIS capability, but in the long term, this is going to have to be exactly as said, I think, a political, economic, and where useful or effective military containment, and try to, with time, pull local groups away from the ISIS movement, which right now is an insurgency and not a global jihadist movement, but clearly could become one. And the Pentagon and intelligence agencies are concerned about the numbers of Westerners that have gone there and that could then, you know, leave and come back to Europe or the United States.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Sean Kay, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book is entitled America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Also, Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar in the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, D.C. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, given the strength of the insurgents now, there's no sense that there's a political diplomatic approach to them at this point. Aaron Miller?
No.
Not at all.
I think, nor was there one to Al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
Or some of the other Sunni jihadi groups.
Mm-hmm.
People compare ISIS to Hamas and Hezbollah, but it goes well beyond there. I mean, you have Caliph Ibrahim Abu Bakr, who purports now to represent the entire Muslim Ummah of a billion people. I mean, which is an extraordinary move. The problem is that he's not some guy living in a cave.
Mm-hmm.
They're smart. They're on the move. They've captured and now have at their disposal hundreds of millions of dollars of Soviet and American military equipment, which they essentially overran when Iraqi army units collapsed during their initial advance. They have run crime and extortion rackets, which have provided them millions, I don't know about billions, but scores of millions of dollars. They have access to hundreds of Western European and international passports.
Mm-hmm.
They have an ideology which allows them to kill Muslims without any regard whatsoever, and they're committed. And as the Kurds found out, they are tactically smart in their initial encounters. and extremely well-disciplined. So I think this is going to be a threat that is more profound, more complex, now localized, which Al-Qaeda was not. It showed up in any number of places. But this is the first example. I guess I would compare it somewhat to the Taliban in Afghanistan, but I think that they're worse.
In terms of their ideology, comparing it to
the
Taliban.
Yeah, they're worse. And unlike Taliban, where Pakistani intelligence, fortunately and unfortunately for us, had all kinds of lines in, at least to the Pakistan part of the movement, and to the Afghanistan part, I think these guys are beyond the influence of most actors in the international system. Now, I don't want to exaggerate this. I mean, you know, the last year, 2013, I think 17,871 people in this world were killed as a consequence of terrorist attacks. 16 Americans were among them. 16 out of 17,891. It's hard to say right now that they are a immediate threat to the homeland, or that terror right now is a strategic threat to the homeland. But, you know, we know from experience that goals and objectives evolve, and it certainly it would be completely irresponsible on one hand to run scared, but on the other to simply suggest that they have other targets in the region and that they will never ever try to strike or inflict a galactic attack on the United States. So we got to find the right balance, and as I mentioned, this is not a week, 2 week, month, or even 6 month enterprise. Obama needs to deal with this, set the stage, and he needs to hand it off to his successor. If he can leave office within less than 1,000 days from now, having checked ISIS's rise, mm-hmm. having created a greater Kurdish military capacity with a government in Iraq that's functional and for whom an Iraqi army would be willing and able to fight, then I think the chances of at least checking ISIS are good. But remember, you have Syria to deal with as well, the mothership.
How is Iran responding to all of this now?
You know, I think they have any number of calculations. They need to, their view of Iraq is fundamentally different from ours.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to see the country disintegrate, but they need to be able to be the predominant, preeminent regional power that affects whoever is going to govern there. And, you know, they know, they understand quite well that Sunni jihadis, the stronger they grow, mm-hmm. that Sunni jihadi threat is going to increase the dependence of Shia Muslims on them. At the same time, they do not want to see a robust American presence return to Iraq.
Right.
I could add one thing to
sure,
that, which
Sean
is Kay. That this is where I think the creative diplomacy is possible, but we're going to have to make some real decisions about how much deeper we want to engage with Iran in this process here. But as Aaron pointed out, if there is a possible diplomatic consortium that involves the Jordanians, the Saudis, and Iran with common interests, then that's certainly something worth pursuing and building on. The place where I'm skeptical, and I'd be curious to know what Aaron thinks about this, but the relative utility of air power against ISIS, it seems really limited. And so the dilemma is, you know, in terms of pure military concepts, if you're really going to go after ISIS, it would involve being on the ground. So the question is whether we can come up with some kind of model that would involve American air power, but with local ground forces coming from mainly Iraq. But at the end of the day, this is going to have to be, as given the nature of the challenge that Aaron describes, not a U.S. versus ISIS operation. This is going to have to really pull in allies. And at the end of the day, part of the reality of what we're dealing with here is that both American broader interests, which include Asia and crises in Ukraine and whatnot, really require getting allies and partners out front on the ground. But at the time, they may not be ready, willing, or able to do it. So well, how do we square that circle is going to be tough.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that British Prime Minister David Cameron returned home to a military talking about that and talking about what their role was going to be.
Well, that was primarily on the humanitarian side,
okay.
if I recall, and that's also a place where the international community, the United Nations, could be pulled in here. And I've been a little concerned that the administration, I understand, given the crisis nature of this, they had to move quickly, but this has not been getting the attention at the UN. It has not been getting the full extent of mobilization. But this is very early in what's going to be a long-term process, so I think that's going to take some time to sort out.
Yeah, Aaron Miller, what about the rest of what about the allies and so forth?
Well, I think, you're going to have to create, I think Sean's right, a kind of coalition of the willing, and then you're going to have to mount an Operation Tin Cup in order to raise money for this. This is a long-term, complicated enterprise, which is going to require putting somebody in this government in charge at a senior level, coordinating an interagency process, and then start knocking on doors. I think most Europeans are going to be reluctant to send ground forces. You may end up convincing some of our NATO allies to participate, perhaps, in intelligence operations and strikes from the air and providing some weapons to the Kurds and the Iraqi military. But I think you're going to end up also having to run an Operation Tin Cup from the Arabs, from the Arab side as well. I mean, it's not Iraq War 1 and 2, and I'm not sure how this president envisions the overall strategy. I'm not sure he has an answer to the problem of how do you really stop ISIS from the air, and I think Sean's right, you can't. At some point, he's going to have to address the Congress and the public here, and he's going to have to be very honest with them about the nature of the threat we face. And then he's going to have to lay out a strategy, which he has not yet done. I suspect something like that could occur in the fall. He has to be pretty sure about his own parameters and his own red lines, because every military analyst I've been hearing on the cable, 24/7 cable chattering classes, has already pointed out the reality that ISIS cannot be stopped or even contained through air power alone. Mm-hmm. And they're all urging the president to, without saying as much, understand that he may end up having to go where he doesn't want to go.
Aaron, you made the point that ISIS doesn't, it's self-supporting now. It doesn't depend on seed money from, those from other countries that have the wealth to pass along. However, are we in a whack-a-mole situation where, hypothetically, if ISIS were destroyed, there'd just be another group that would pop up behind them, because ultimately that seed money is out there?
Well, I think in the case of ISIS, a conclusive defeat, and remember, we're not just talking about a military defeat. ISIS feeds on two things: the dysfunction of failed or failing states, and the dissatisfaction of the Sunni community that they represent. And Sunnis in Iraq are feeling completely disenfranchised. Worse than that, their Maliki oppressed and persecuted them. I mean, he put all of his own cronies and loyalists in key positions in the Iraqi military and security forces. It's no wonder they collapsed in the face of an ISIS threat. I mean, why would you want to fight? Why would a Shia want to fight for a government that, or a Sunni want to fight for a government that didn't have its own best interests at heart? So you need, to deal with ISIS, you're going to need a functional Iraqi state, some measure of power sharing, and a reasonable political contract in which most Iraqis actually believe the government, whether they're Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia, are actually working to further and advance the interests of all of those confessional communities. You don't have that. You put that together with an Iraqi state that actually works, together with an international response to ISIS, which would include economic assistance and military assistance. I think there'd be a reasonable chance that you could hold it at bay. Taking ISIS territory back, however, is another matter. Only ground troops can do that, and I'm hoping they won't have to be American ground troops.
Aaron David Miller, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Aaron David Miller is Distinguished Scholar in the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. His most recent book is called The End of Greatness, Why America Can't Have and Doesn't Want Another Great President. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The humanitarian crisis on Mount Sinjar in Iraq has ended, but the ISIS threat is far from over, and the United States' policy in Iraq and the larger implications of America re-entering Iraq in a military level is up for discussion. That's what we've been talking about. Still with us is the director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University, Sean Kay. His new book is entitled America's Search for Security and the Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Sean, I have not read the book yet, but I'm wondering, are we in the return of realism stage now?
Well, that's a broader geopolitical framework. But as Aaron Miller was describing, part of that has been to find ways to reduce our getting pulled into these peripheral conflicts around the Persian Gulf. And in places like Europe and the Middle East, find ways to get allies and partners out front taking responsibility for their own security, primarily while America gradually shifts its priorities to Asia, which is, in fact, the key future area of the structure of world politics. The dilemma of that is that we have for 20 years now had a foreign policy that has been basically a loose consensus between liberal interventionists and neoconservatives who continue to push for the priorities being either Europe or the Middle East, because these have been the places that have been the priorities for the last 20 years. And so the idea of realism means a number of things, but we have to, first and foremost, it means being honest with ourselves about what we can do and accomplish. And I think the previous discussion we were having suggests that this is going to be a tricky knot to tie, because at the end of the day, however, the idea, for example, of moving towards Asia and our priorities does not mean leaving these places. Rather, it means creating a hierarchy of priorities. And I think the president is trying to not doing it in a way that's been very effective in terms of explaining it to the American public or Congress, but trying to find ways to get allies and partners out front in these regions, working with the United States. And, the idea that we've left or abandoned regions, which some critics have alleged, it's just simply not the case. And, we saw 13,000 troops in Kuwait. We have significant naval and air power all around that region. The real problem is that the military tool in the long run will probably be the least effective priority, because we have to decide, how far we want to go, given the limited utility of air power against a group like ISIS.
Emmanuel in Westerville, you're on the air. Hi, Emmanuel. You're on the air with Sean Kay.
Hello, Anna. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
My question to your guest is, what is the ideology behind this regime change that the United States always keeps embarking on that never produces anything? We did it in Iran. Today, Iran is our enemies because we did it in 1953. That we did it in Libya. Libya is a disaster. Nobody's talking about it. We did it in Iraq.
So why is the United States involved at that level of discussion?
And why is the United States keep doing regime change that never produces anything?
Okay. All right. Sean Kay?
Look, it's very hard to find a lot of evidence that this previous 20-year period of priorities has created a lot of success stories in terms of military intervention in places like Iraq. And the root dilemma of this problem, of course, you know, really does have to be said. The conflict itself could be framed in the much larger centuries-old conflict between Shiites and Sunnis, but anyone who wanted to invade Iraq in 2003 sure as heck should have been well aware of that. And for whatever reason, we didn't account for it very effectively. I mean, it was very obvious that if you have, you know, once we have democracy and elections, which is idealistic in the sense that we want to spread democracy, spread freedom, do what we can in places, but, you know, do something, which seems to be the chorus often, is not a strategy. It's a platitude, and it doesn't really bring a lot of effect. And so the idea that we could have toppled Saddam Hussein and have some kind of flourishing democracy was simply not grounded in any basis of history or reality. And I think the American public are very well aware of that. And the flip side of an example is where we can see effectiveness in a different approach comes out of actually the Syria conflict. I think some critics are now saying that we should have been much more involved in Syria. I think that's really easy to say after the fact and completely ignores the complexity of the opposition movement that became ISIS involved in Syria. But on the issue, for example, last fall, we got a better outcome, quite frankly, with regard to Assad and his chemical weapons with diplomacy. I mean, more chemical weapons were destroyed there through the United Nations inspectors going in and doing it than would have been had we gone to war. So part of return to realism means having a very clear-eyed hierarchy of assessment of what's possible and what's attainable in the world. And that doesn't mean not doing humanitarian operations either where they can be effective. I don't think anyone could have looked at the imagery of the people trying to get on a helicopter that was seen on CNN and think, if we could do something about it, we should try and do it if we can. But it really means having a very clear-eyed assessment about what's possible and what are the appropriate tools to be effective when we apply foreign policy. The simple idea of regime change, which really was driven not only by the neoconservatives over the last 20 years, but also by Democrats, too. I mean, it's important to note, Bill Clinton signed off on the Iraq Liberation Act late in his administration. Hillary Clinton supported invading Iraq. We in this country also have to have a very serious discussion about our priorities. Quite frankly, I believe the American public is so far ahead on that issue, and it's Washington that has yet to really catch up with it.
Raman in Canton, you're on the air. Hi, Raman.
How you doing, man?
Thank you. I'm fine. Thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, my question is, how come U.S. policy never say nothing regarding Saudi Arabia. Mm. And the main problem in Middle East, at Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabi Takfiri branch in Islam.
Yeah.
A lot of funding comes from Saudi Arabia for some of these groups, right?
Well, and we've also, and we have kind of stood back in the case of Syria and kind of let Saudi Arabia and Jordan take the lead and working there on the ground. With some minor assistance to the groups that we could vet, in effect. But I think that raises a larger question about, you know, where America can have influence. I find it odd, for example, that America should be criticized for what's gone on in Syria for not having done something. I mean, the person who's responsible for what's happening in Syria is Assad, and he is not our patron by any means. We have no relationship in that regard with him, but we do have deep ties with a number of other governments around the region, and many of them are not liberal democracies by any means, and that's part of the trick. You know, how do we figure out where we can put pressure and make a difference? But we have not been willing to put pressure on some of the key allies that could be. So Saudi Arabia could and should be doing a lot more, particularly to condemn and challenge ISIS. But they have a history of sort of exporting their problems into other countries like Afghanistan and elsewhere. And it's a very short-sighted, short-term view. And we need to have some very effective and quiet but effective behind-the-scenes diplomacy with Saudi Arabia. You know, the Saudis and Israel were very critical of our outreach to Iran on their nuclear program. I think the Saudis are concerned that we could succeed in Iran. And at some point, you know, when we want to put our allies and partners out front, we also have to be willing to say to our allies, it's, you know, we've been there, America's been there for since World War II for you guys. It's time for you also, you know, being in an allies and partners is a two-way street. And when America has national interests, we also have a reasonable expectation that our allies will share our national interests and support us just as they would expect us to support them. And so that's something I think that the American public and taxpayer has a very reasonable expectation that the countries that we have backed unquestioningly for a very long time could step up to the plate now and share some of that responsibility and burden.
Why do they operate the way they do? They benefit from our conflict with Iraq and Iran and Syria, right?
I think it's a very, very simple equation. They know very well that if they don't do it, we will. And that's a dilemma because, on the other hand, in terms of military operations, for example, we do provide the essential enabling forces that are necessary. For example, France went into Mali about a year and a half ago, but they couldn't really sustain the operation without American transport, intelligence sharing. The Libya war was very similar, too. I mean, it was a NATO operation, but the infrastructure of that war could not have happened without the American enabling forces. And at some point, especially with regard, for example, to the European allies, I think Aaron is exactly right that we shouldn't expect much from Europe on this. But part of that is because the European allies are pursuing their national interests and calculating their interests in terms that suggest that, you know, they don't have to, because at the end of the day, they think we'll provide for the stability and security that they benefit from.
And is that something we've nurtured, though?
We have not been willing to make really hard. We keep criticizing allies and saying they should do more, but we're not really willing to make the steps that would change that incentive basis. And the one place where we could really do that is Europe. I mean, here we are, you know, how many decades after World War II? And it's certainly, you know, Europe doesn't really need to spend more, for example, on defense. They need to pool their resources better and be more effective, and they should be responsible for their own peripheral security concerns, which very much include this problem of ISIS, because there's many European passport holders that will return from there, and that's going to be a problem for them if they don't get organized and proactive. But if the European allies feel that we're going to be the ones there to provide for this, they'll free ride on it and continue to sit back passively.
What do you agree? I mean, you said that you mostly agree with what Aaron Miller was saying, that this is not something that's going to go away in 1 or 2 years. It's certainly not something that will go away by the time Barack Obama leaves office, or probably his predecessor as well. It sounded like, to hear Aaron David Miller talk about it, this is forever now.
Well, he used the key word that we really have to launch a serious discussion about in Washington and the think tanks with Congress and in the Pentagon and elsewhere. Both, A, how do we get allies and partners out front? And B, what does containment mean in the 21st century? I mean, you know, containment of the Soviet Union was an obvious and pretty straightforward thing to do with conventional military power. Now we're dealing with non-conventional threats. We know that the regime change thing has failed. We know that the and at minimum, you know, if you're going to do it, you better be sure to win the peace once you win the war, or you're going to have a whole new series of decades-long problems, as we've seen in Afghanistan and Libya and Iraq. So we really need to have a discussion about what this, you know, what a new strategy of containment would look like with regard to groups like this, because at the end of the day, we're not going to be willing to put the literally tens of thousands, I think, would be necessary at least of troops on the ground to really destroy ISIS. And so, and we're not going to do it by air power. So we're going to have a much more longer-term concept. And containment means, you know, sort of being willing to live with certain kinds of things and make sure that they don't spread, in effect, and putting an array of tools in place, political, diplomatic, economic, intelligence, and military. It's not a passive policy, but it does mean being willing to look much more carefully at how we address our national interests and how we apply power.
Sean Kay, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sean Kays, director of the Arneson Institute for Practical Politics and Public Affairs at Ohio Wesleyan University. His new book is entitled America's Search for Security, The Triumph of Idealism and the Return of Realism. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.